Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today, I'll be talking with choreographer Sarah Bush about the world premiere of her new dance project, Spirit and Bones, which features an intergenerational cast of 15 women, aged 23 to over 70. The performance features an original score performed by Skip the Needle, several members of which will also be here in studio for a conversation. From Central Works in Berkeley, I'll talk with actors Ed Berkeley and Richard Frederick about their roles in Gary Graves' adaptation of Ward 6, an 1892 short story by writer Anton Chekhov. A conversation with American composer Kevin Putz about the San Francisco Symphony's world premiere performance of his Silent Night Elegy, an instrumental piece based on his own Pulitzer Prize-winning opera, Silent Night, from 2011. Plus, our regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson reviews two movies, Tea with the Dames, a documentary with and about four of the world's most celebrated actresses, Dames Eileen Atkins, Judi Dench, Joan Plowright, and Maggie Smith, and the movie The Old Man and the Gun, an American crime comedy written and directed by David Lowery, featuring Robert Redford, Casey Affleck, Danny Glover, among others. Stay with us, a full hour of interesting things for you to consider here in the Bay Area. That's part of the soundscape from the group Skip the Needle that will be heard this weekend as an intergenerational cast of Bay Area dance luminaries performs the world premiere of Spirit and Bones by Sarah Bush Dance Project. Joining me in studio is the eponymous Sarah Bush, as well as three members of Skip the Needle, composer-bassist Vicky Randall, guitarist Katie Cash, and composer-pianist Julie Wolf. Welcome to you all to our studios.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Quite a gang we have here to talk about this. Let's start with you, Sarah. What was the inspiration for Spirit and Bones?
Well, it's an idea I'd had for a while about wanting to make a work about this time of year, the time of year when the days are getting shorter, the nights are getting longer, there's more darkness, and an opportunity to look at everything that is beautiful and rich and powerful about darkness. So celebrating the time of year. And then after the last presidential election, I felt, once I got off the couch and Netflix, I felt really moved to make work that was honoring women very explicitly, and honoring women in every age and stage of their life and experience. So it was really clear to me I wanted to make intergenerational work. And I've had the opportunity to work with a couple of the dancers who are in the show before. And last year, worked with Joan Lazarus and Su Li Ju, and had the gift of working with them and seeing that their years of experience as dancers and as performers was so moving and powerful on stage. So I was excited to just broaden that experience that much more. So yeah, we've got dancers who are incredible at age 23 up to 71, all of them just outstanding in their field.
Well, I was going to ask how you found some of these dancers. And I know that my own 56-year-old body does not perform like my 23rd-year-old body as much as I am denial about that.
Yeah.
So what is it like as a dancer aging, knowing that you could do some things that you can't do some things you could do before?
Yeah, I'm exactly in the middle. I'm 42. And so I feel like I'm at that exact crossroads where I'm so aware of the things that my body isn't as good at doing anymore, but I'm also really aware of the things I am better at doing. And I think that's what we're all looking at in this show, that there's things your body can do when you're 23, and there's things that your performance quality and your life experience, the way you carry yourself on stage, that actually deepens and I think becomes more rich as you age. So
yeah, there's an interesting analogy. As a musician, a flutist, you know, I play Mozart a little bit differently than I did when I was a 23-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, I bring a little bit of experience that it makes up for maybe the facility that might not be as fast.
I think everyone can probably relate to it in their own field, that there's things that we let go of, but there's things that we continue to deepen our expertise at.
Well, I'm hoping that this, as much as the election and the current occupant has served as some sort of inspiration for this, that it's becoming a positive event that's coming out of this, of
Very
course.
Much so. I feel like we're all already feeling it in the theater, that with everything that's going on in the world, with our personal lives, there is always so much loss and so much hard news and so much struggle, that to come together and feel like we are bringing together our energy to shift that, to it's spirit and bones. It feels like we are pushing out with this spirit of power, of hope, of optimism, of another way of looking at how we're all relating in the world. And that's hopefully just flooding right out of that beautiful theater there.
Fantastic. That's going to be at the Wilsey Center for Opera and the Taube Atrium Theater. Great space for that, too.
Gorgeous, yes.
We need to involve some of the wonderful musicians that are involved in this production. Bassist composer Vicki Rendell, formerly of The Tonight Show and currently backing Mavis Staples, renowned side player, composer, pianist Julie Wolfe, guitarist Katie Cash, all part of the group Skip the Needle. So, Vicki, tell me a little bit about the group and who you are. You are just the three of them, three of you right now.
Right. So named because each one of us in this band, when we started out, come from a really different musical tradition, and each had our own bands for years. Katie's the resident shredder. you can speak for yourself about your background, you know.
just in terms of playing, I primarily have fronted rock bands or been part of more traditional rock bands. So this is a different experience for me, definitely.
Right.
Yeah, a very enriching experience. But
yeah, we brought in. We're bringing in Coffee Brown from the Coffee Brown Band, who is an MC and is like an R&B and funktress, and Shelley Doty, who's also a shredder, just a slightly different shredding trajectory coming from the jam band land, you know, and Julie Wolfe, who is iconic as a composer and a player. Not going to talk for you.
Well, I'll talk about my background a little bit and how it folds into this piece. I come from an improvisational background. I came up as a jazz musician. I was on the road with singer-songwriters for over 20 years, and now I'm off the road and producing music. And the improvisation background is really serving me and I think our group as we hold space for Sarah's dancers. Vicki did the lion's share of the composing for this piece, and so there are structured pieces and some improvisational moments within those structured pieces, mm-hmm. but there are also interstitial pieces that are completely improvised and created from feeling what's happening in the room and watching the movement,
yes.
and watching the faces of the dancers.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, in classical ballet, certain marks have to be hit in the score to coordinate with the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case with the score for Spirit and Bones?
It's much more fluid than that. Please,
maybe not.
Yeah. I think there's a mix.
Yeah,
we've got a real range in the show. That there's one song in the middle of the show that feels like it's a real funk rock piece, mm-hmm. and that is completely has to go the same, pretty much the same way every time.
Yeah.
There's other sections where I think we all wanted to keep it very much alive, so that there was room for the expression to be a conversation. For as dancers performing to live music. Is a whole other experience than recorded music. Mm-hmm. I've been talking about it as sort of three-dimensional sound versus two-dimensional sound. Mm-hmm. But so I love that it is the energy in the room is alive and we're responding to it. So there's definitely a mix. There's some stuff that there's a track underneath and they're playing live on top of. Other things are very set and very improvised. But there are some marks. We went through some of those yesterday.
Yeah, I know. This is the first time that this is the first time that I've done this out of that I've sort of. Organized. It's more organizing than composing, really, although I did compose a piece. But one of my great loves in performance is the fact that I perform live and do something different every day. That's like, that's where I feel like I have my strengths. And I've always wondered if you could take that, the idea of live performing, of improvisation, and work it in with dancers who are also improvising at the same time. So there's some of that going on. Julie has this beautiful piece at the beginning where it's just improvisation. And there's some of that in the finale especially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's so much fun because I can actually watch the dancers responding to what we're doing live.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And we might not do it again the next night. So you have to come all three
all
nights.
All three nights. Yeah.
Right. Well, we talked about your colleagues not having worked with dance that much. Vicky, have you done much with dancers before?
You know, most of my career I've been a drummer, a percussionist, and I started, as most drummers do, playing for dance companies because they just let you sit there.
And no, I think you probably started banging on things in your mom's house to her chagrin.
My mother would not allow that to happen. I had to wait until I left. She was not going to stand for that. So when I lived at home, I had to play guitar, But by the time I was about 16, 17, I was playing for dance companies, but I've never done anything like this. This is amazing. Yeah,
I don't think any of us have ever done anything like this before. This feels like such wonderful, huge.
It's scary and it's fun and it's. Yeah. It's scary and it's fun, and it goes back and forth.
And it's Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 7 at the Taube Atrium Theater at the Wilsey Center for Opera here in San Francisco. Tickets are at sarahbushdance.org. We're going to hear one more track to go out with. What are we hearing in Youth Beats?
Oh, this is the electronic music piece.
It's for the group that's the youngest dancers.
Yeah.
So the progression of the show really started with sort of handheld skin instruments moving through metal and rock and then adding in this processed sound. So we're at the youngest dancers taking flight in this one.
Yeah.
More music from Vicky Rendell. Thank you all for coming in today.
Thank you
for having us.
Performed by Skip the Needle, who will be live and recorded for performances of Spirit and Bones by the Sarah Bush Dance Project. Tomorrow, Saturday at 8, Sunday at 7, sarahbushdance.org to learn all of the details. It's a great pleasure to welcome to my studio, the KLW studio. I don't want to pretend ownership in any case of this. The great composer, Kevin Putz, who is having his world premiere of a orchestral version of his Pulitzer Prize-winning opera, Silent Night, premiered by the San Francisco Symphony. And it's a debut operatic endeavor that did win you the Pulitzer, Kevin. Congratulations on that. The full opera, Silent Night, was premiered at the Minnesota Opera in November of 2011, the West Coast premiere by Opera San Jose here in 2015. Already in high demand, but the Pulitzer seemed to make the phone ring a little bit more.
Well, you know, it was one of those things that sort of felt like it came out of the blue. I had written mostly orchestral music prior to writing my first opera in 2009. I guess I started the piece, and people had always said, you know, there's a kind of storytelling element to your music, and it's lyrical, you should write an opera. And I just didn't know how to even begin an endeavor like that. So when this call came in from Minnesota Opera to do an operatic version of the French film Joyeux Noël, I watched the film and I thought, sure, why not? Let's, you know, give it a shot.
Well, for those unfamiliar with the entire story, in a nutshell, tell us the story.
It's amazing. It's based on the actual events that happened on the first Christmas Eve of World War I, when soldiers from the opposing sides, the French and the Scottish were on one side, the Germans on the other, in many places along the Western Front, decided to just sort of get out of their trenches and celebrate together. And it lasted for at least a day. They played soccer together. They shared champagne and chocolates and pictures of their family and their girlfriends back home. And it was an unbelievable event. And the way Mark Campbell, the librettist for the opera, structured the opera.
Who also just did the libretto for the Life of Steve Jobs.
Yes,
from
absolutely.
Space.
Wonderful opera. Yeah, and so the piece is really about, the first act is about this happening, the lead up to this crazy moment in history where, you know, a war is put on hold and the soldiers are intermingling. And then the second act is really about, well, what do we do now? So we're supposed to go back and kill each other now that we know each other? And that's the questions that it asks. So. Mm-hmm.
And with Minnesota Opera also commissioned the Manchurian Candidate as a result. So
right.
It's also under your belt, as well as symphonies and other music that's been performed around the world. And an affiliation with writing for voice. You did a wonderful work for Renee Fleming.
That's a, yeah.
George O'Keefe writings.
Mm-hmm, that's a piece I'm still working on. I wrote Renee a song cycle based on these amazing letters by Georgia O'Keeffe that I'm not sure people know, but she wrote thousands of letters to Alfred Stieglitz, who was her husband, and he wrote letters back. And so what I sort of pieced together a libretto, a song cycle for her, and now we're expanding it into a bigger piece with baritone. So you have Georgia O'Keeffe and Stieglitz singing these letters to each other, and so they're duets and there's sort of more interaction between them. That's going to premiere next summer, but that's a much bigger 45 to 50 minute long piece.
Great, and that I hope has a West Coast element at some point.
I hope so. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I think that's true, though. Mm-hmm. So
back to writing a symphonic version of Silent Night. Who was the inspiration for that?
Well, you know, my experience before writing the opera was mainly orchestral, so I guess people notice the orchestral music more than they notice the vocal music from the opera, and a few people have suggested, you know, you should make a piece out of just the orchestral music, as operas have, you know, composers have done with various operas, Rosenkavalier, and my favorite example of that is the 4C interludes based on music from Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten. I was not able to make a suite of separate movements. It just didn't work out as well. So what I've done is made a sort of unbroken single movement piece about 20 minutes long that essentially outlines the story of the opera. I mean, it kind of tells the entire story.
Intended to be programmatic and yes. evocative of the, yes, the whole right. story that's mm-hmm. going on. And it's was a commission by the co-commissioned by the San Francisco Symphony, Indianapolis Symphony, and St. Louis Symphony. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And what do you think? Is it something that's going to be revised, or are you happy with
no,
the final
No, I don't
result?
Think so, actually. I mean, and I'm the first to revise my work sort of obsessively, but I'm really happy. And it's a lot of that is just because the orchestra is so amazing. And Christian Masolaro, who's conducting it, who I have not worked with before, has become a great friend of composers, and he really knows how it works, you know, how to premiere a piece and the kind of things that we need to adjust. And I feel really excited. You know, we just heard the dress rehearsal of it in the last hour and a half, and it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, you have a wonderful gift for orchestration, and I always hearken back to, you know, some of the great Russian orchestrators. Did you take a page out of Rimsky-Korsakov?
Oh, I mean, if I could orchestrate like Stravinsky, you know, yeah. it would be, you know, I mean, Stravinsky and Ravel are, you know, inspirations. And I got to say, John Williams, you know, yeah. those pieces just come off the stage. I mean, his orchestral music for the films. And there's definitely a cinematic element in my music, too. Mm-hmm. So.
And so who was the guiding hand for you as you were coming together as a composer? Or is it just your own ear?
Really artistically and musically, basically my own ear. I mean, I had really supportive teachers who just sort of let me be who I was instead of trying to make me be someone else. And so I had a lot of different teachers, and they were all great. And I learned something different from each of them. But I think I've always felt like there's a kind of music that I love, and I want to write it no matter what, you know, the kind of fallout is from that. And sometimes it's difficult, you know, you get resistance from various places, but I definitely had supportive teachers.
You mentioned a couple of things that are coming up. What else are you looking forward to of your own works being done?
This new piece about O'Keefe and Stieglitz is called The Brightness of Light. That'll premiere next summer, and it's going to several opera companies, orchestras and a couple of opera companies. And I'm right now about to start working on an opera for the Met, actually, which
Fantastic.
Will be, yeah, that'll be about 4 years down the road. I'm not supposed to talk about what it's all about, but I'm excited about it, and so, and then a string quartet for the Miro String Quartet, which they will premiere next summer as well.
Fantastic. The orchestral version of a suite from Silent Night called Silent Night Elegy by Kevin Putz is going to be on the program this weekend with the San Francisco Symphony. The program also includes works by Anna Klein, her Masquerade, Lalo's Symphonie Espagnole, as well as the suite from Der Rosenkavalier. That's and Christian Masolaro conducting all of that. Congratulations on that, and let's have you back to talk more about the things that are down the pike for you.
Thank you.
We're going to hear the vocal version of the aria. Tell us what we're going to be hearing here.
This is
you will hear part of that as an orchestral version in this suite. Is that correct?
Yes. This is an aria sung by a French lieutenant who had just come out of this battle, and he's recording the names and the birthplaces of the dead and the wounded from the battle, and at the same time he's singing about his wife back at home who's just had a baby, and he wasn't home for it. So,
Thanks for coming in, Kevin.
Thank you. La Rochelle Fauchon André 20 ans Saint-Brieuc Madeleine J'ai perdu ta photo Celle près des lilas Avec Charles, 30 ans, Cancale, je l'ai bien embrassé plus de 5 fois par jour. Mort, Vernis, Henri Paul, 30 ans, Amiens, mes pochettes. Et tu es là.
Je finirai demain.
Some of the amazing music from the Pulitzer Prize-winning score by Kevin Putz from 2011, Silent Night, his opera, an orchestral version having its world premiere with the San Francisco Symphony this weekend on a program that also includes works by Anna Klein, Lalo, and Richard Strauss, the suite from Der Rosenkavalier, under the direction of guest conductor Christian Massolaro. Information at sfsymphony.org. Still to come, Peter Robinson will be by to review two movies, Tea with the Dames and The Old Man and the Gun, and he'll give a preview of Late Tsarist Russian Artistic Brilliance, a two-day program of lectures, discussions, and musical performances about Russian art, music, and literature from the twilight years of Tsarist Russia. That's going to be at Humanities West on November 2nd and 3rd. Well, directed by Gary Graves, Central Works' 2018 tale of madness, alienation, and moral responsibility, Chekhov's Ward 6, with lead actors Ed Berkeley and Richard Frederick, will be the 61st world premiere presented by Central Works and closes their 2018 season. With us today are actors Richard Frederick and Ed Berkeley, the leads from the production of Ward 6. It's the third novella of Chekhov to be adapted by Central Works and runs through November 11th at Berkeley City Club on Durant Avenue in Berkeley. Ed Berkeley, no relation to the city, is a Bay Area-based film and stage actor originally from the East Coast for the past 4 years. Ed has been in numerous productions within the Bay Area theater scene, including stints with the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival, San Francisco Playhouse, Cutting Ball Theater, and Theater First. Welcome to you, Ed.
Thank you.
And Richard Frederick has appeared in several Central Works shows, as well as with the aforementioned SF Playhouse and Theater First, Center Rep, ACT, and 42nd Street Moon, among others. He's also been seen in stages in Washington, D.C., New York, and Texas. A very nice welcome to you.
Thank you.
Richard, happy to have you here. Richard, you play hospital director Dr. Reagan,
Ragin.
Yeah. Oh, third pronunciation's a charm.
Yeah.
And the patient, Ivan, is played by Ed Berkeley. Welcome to you all. So tell us a little bit about what Chekhov's Ward 6 is about. It's a patient-doctor relationship for the most part. Who wants to tackle that first? You're tossing off.
Well, I guess I'll start.
Here's Richard.
Since I'm the doctor and the runner of the hospital. It's a tale about a doctor who is caught in this far remote Russian village, 200 miles from the nearest railway station. When you think about that, it's a pretty remote place in Russia. And he runs this, he's a lead doctor in this hospital that has many different wards, but one of the main wards is a mental institution. And it's about his inaction and his desire to see change, but his complete lack of any steps toward effecting change. And then he meets a young, very intelligent inmate, if you will, in the mental institution, and they develop a relationship or friendship. Well, however complex that relationship is, yeah, it's a very one-sided friendship. But anyway, and then things kind of spiral out of control for him from that point on, and so that's the gist of it, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Richard, you've been a part of the development team of all three of Central Works' adaptations of Chekhov works with Gary Graves. Are there common threads between the three? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think with the three short stories that I've been a part of that they've dramatized, it's really a lot about Gary uses the term Russian layabout, lieabout, very intellectual people or pseudo-intellectual, if you will, in a lot of ways, who look inward but don't affect any change in their environment. And so they choose comfort over action. So that's kind of the common thread between the three, if you will. Very internal people struggling with self-identity, existentialism, if you will, in some respects. So that's kind of the common thread between the three of them.
Mm-hmm. And Ed Berkeley, what's your relationship with Chekhov?
I've never had the pleasure to do a Chekhov piece before. So my first piece of Chekhov being a story that's been adapted has been pretty interesting, and it's making me want to dive into more pieces in the future. But this is it.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about your character, Ivan. Or is it Ivan? Come on, help me out with the pronunciation here.
It is Ivan. Yes, it is Ivan. My relationship to Ivan... Let me just get into the character itself. So his relationship to Andrei Ragin is he's simply someone who is scolding this lie about once he finally interacts with someone who's part of the system who he's been the victim of. So he's a victim of the system that's essentially imprisoned him in this ward, in this very unkept, completely abandoned ward, where the only person that's really in charge is this this brute with this stick, which is a direct quote from the show. So that is my relationship to him. And as someone who has felt like a victim of the system before, I definitely relate to his character a lot. And I think anyone who will see it who also has felt victimized by the system or any system will also relate to him as well.
Mm. And you're a man who's in the depths of poverty, mm-hmm. and not sure whether you should be institutionalized. Is that a fact?
yeah. So he's again. It was a series of events that ultimately led him to this very peculiar situation where he is in prison. But he actually comes from wealth, and he is an educated man because he comes from wealth. And his wealth that he had at one point gave him the opportunity of education, and he just slowly lost it. And now he's just this ridiculously educated man who's having this spewing this rhetoric back and forth with this doctor.
That's an interesting thing because you talk about poverty and it plays a part in this story pretty critically toward the end of the story. But I was watching a show on CBS the other night, And one of the phrases was, it was about the criminalization of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, you know, that's really kind of interesting statement, because it affects our show very drastically when you lose the ability to, because his character actually, when he was younger, had means to basically avoid the system.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to skirt around being institutionalized. And when that money went away, he lost that ability to buffer himself from it, and he gets institutionalized. It plays in with my character at some mm-hmm. point, too.
Mm-hmm. And can't help but resonate right now with Bay Area subject matter.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Obviously a very heady subject, but one of Chekhov's strengths, who himself was a physician, by the way, is his injection of humor. Now, is that the case with Ward 6? Do we get to see a bit of the character where the audience actually knows more about the character than the character himself?
I think I'm sorry. I think no. that there is
Richard
a character.
Frederick, once again.
Thank you. There's a character in the show that neither of our characters, but there is one character in the show that kind of has a buffoonish quality that generates some of the humor. But it's not just from him being a buffoon. I think he is the one character who has no concept of self-awareness, and that the audience sees him, and that's where a lot of the humor generates from. Our characters, I think, both of our characters seem to be pretty self-aware. I think they're aware. My character particularly, who is the driver of the story, if you will, talks and talks and talks about all the problems, and yet says clearly, look, I can't, there's nothing I can do. I'm just one person, and I'm part of a large system. I there's nothing I can affect by myself, which is pathetic in this sense, because we see him being someone who can actually take you know, take action and stuff. And I think that you talk about today's resonance with today's world and situations and problems like homelessness, which seems insurmountable. And people go, well, what can I really do? You know, I can give a dollar to somebody or $5 to somebody, but what can I really do to affect change? So, I mean, I think those kind of things are pretty profound correlation between our show and what's happening now. But
yeah. Oh, no, I was just laughing at the humor that is in there. You would think going into a show called Ward 6 and the way that it's aesthetically played, there is no humor, but surprisingly there is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the supporting cast. Let me just reintroduce you. Ed Berkeley playing Ivan in Ward 6 by Chekhov, being presented by Central Works. Richard Frederick as Dr. Ragin, the head of the ward and of the mental hospital itself. And it's at the Central Works performance is going to be at the Berkeley City Club through November 11th. Richard, go on. You were mentioning more about that.
Well, we were just talking about, Ed was going to say something about the humor, and you were asking about other characters
yeah.
in the show. We have a nice ensemble of six total actors, Ed and I, and then four others, who the other four get to play a variety of different people. They all double at least one other role.
Sort of a Greek chorus.
Yeah, sort of a Greek chorus. And they have, even though some of their characters don't actually get to talk, you get a real – what Gary's done is set the play. And obviously it's – if no one's ever been to the City Club, I urge you to come, because it's a wonderful little venue to see a show. It's very – cinematic in some respects, that you're so intimate with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, he set it to in this room, and the room, the City Club, is kind of stark. It's a lot of cement walls, hard flooring. There's not a lot of warmth in there, so you get the sense that these characters are living in this really desolate kind of place. And then everybody, characters interact. Some of the characters are sitting in the audience, with the audience, and they're part of the inmates. So, it's a very intimate kind of space and an intimate kind of show. And so you don't get to escape it. You know what I mean? If you come watch the show, you're part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like we're asking you to participate, but you're part of it just by the fact that you're the proximity to us and the other actors.
So the third adaptation you and the team and Gary Graves have done of Chekhov, are you looking for more? Is Chekhov a focal point for you guys, or what other works might you be having in the hopper? Ed Berkeley is going to address
this. Well, apparently there are hundreds of stories that Chekhov has written, so I'm sure as long as Gary Graves wants to continue to do stories, he'll have plenty of them to do. I personally wouldn't want to continue with these stories. I think adapting it has been stressful for me.
Really?
Just as an actor, actor. Gary has put us in a seat, which I think is a privilege as well, of making us collaborators. So we had a workshop over the summer where we workshopped it, and we had a first draft where it was just like maybe 5 pages, and then eventually we had the entire thing. And that was a really great process to be a part of. But usually I'm just in the seat of the actor. The words are there for me. The director has a vision, and I just contribute my part of the pot, if you will. But this is just, it's been a weird process for me, and it's made me have to just be more versatile than usual, which has been a nice exercise, but it's also just like I'd rather have someone have the words written for me, and then I can just go on my journey of interpretation from there. So it's been rewarding, but it's also not something that I want to continue to do in the future.
Okay, always a dangerous question, Ed Berkeley. What's coming up after this for you?
What's coming up
for
after
actors?
This? you know, for the first time in a long time, fortunately, I don't know. I'm a teaching artist at the moment, and I do commercials on the side. But in terms of a production that's already lined up, I don't know. It's up in the air for the first time, so freedom.
a little
break.
A little breather. Yeah, that's good. And how about you, Richard? What's in the hopper for you?
Same. The eternal quest, you know, looking for work. That's our job.
Yeah.
It's like, as an actor, you spend more time looking for work than having work. So.
Chekhov's Ward 6, written and directed by Gary Graves in collaboration with Ed Berkeley and Richard Frederick, my guests today, along with a supporting cast. It is at the Berkeley City Club on Durant Avenue in the eponymously named Berkeley. No Ed related. Through November 11th, find out more at centralworks.org. Thanks for coming in, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dark music for perhaps some dark subject matter. Ward 6 by Anton Chekhov at CentralWorks. CentralWorks.org for more information.
There is nothing like a day, nothing in the world. There is nothing you can name.
That's today's non sequitur. Nothing like a dame introducing a segment with Peter Robinson with a couple of movie reviews, including a movie about several grand dames. Huh, Peter?
Hi, David. Good to be here. Yes, and perhaps we should rephrase Oscar and Hammerstein with There's Nothing Like Four Dames, because in fact, the movie that I'm going to be reviewing to start with is called Tea with the Dames. And the dames, of course, are Joan Plowright, Judi Dench, Eileen Atkins, and, of course, the immortal Maggie Smith. And perhaps I should explain the actual use of the word dame in terms of British hierarchy. When you are awarded in the New Year's Honours List the Queen, you can become a knight, you can become a lord, or if you're a woman, you can become a dame. So these four dames are dames of the British Empire. And indeed, the flag is flying high as they join conversation, in fact, in Joan Plowright's cottage. And it is a wonderful trip down memory lane. Many of us will remember movies we've seen them in, plays that they have performed, and in a couple of instances, two of them I've interviewed on different occasions. So it kicks off with a general conversation talking about the theatre, and Judi Dench is essentially leading the conversation on many of these occasions. And it seems strange to see somebody who's played Cleopatra. I remember seeing her playing against Anthony Hopkins in Antony and Cleopatra, but has also played in James Bond movies. So you're getting the full range of a very sophisticated actress, and indeed all the others have the same claim to fame. I think it's also a movie about aging gracefully and aging with wit. And leading the wit, I would put Maggie Smith at the top of the list. She is totally with it. We get cuts from her when she was in Downton Abbey, but we also go back each time they join in a conversation to flashes in my own head. And I remember her playing in The Pride of Mistreen Brodie, which was a wonderful act. So you've got four outstanding actresses, and one person they often share in common is the late husband of Joan Plowright, Laurence Olivier. He features on stage. He played and actually argued with Maggie Smith, and one of the best lines, I think, comes halfway through, and Maggie Smith is describing a scene on stage when Laurence Olivier slaps her, and slaps her pretty hard. And she said, "It's the only time I've ever seen stars at the National Theatre."
She
sort of passed out, but she came to. Eileen Atkins, whom I interviewed several years ago when she was here in San Francisco playing in Virginia Woolf, again, is another very solid, enlightening performance. So what you're really experiencing is impromptu, ad-lib, memories coming to life from four really outstanding actresses. And what it reminded me of was a little bit about a jazz quartet, and every so often one member of the jazz quartet will take off into a piece of improv, and they will bring their own individual interpretation of how a piece of music is happening. And here, it's how an individual act was happening, how an individual play was developing. And I think is below this experience of the stage, experience of the movie, and you get the sense that you're actually having tea. It is the title, Tea with the Dames. And one reason you feel you're having tea is sometimes members of the crew will saunter across, they'll reposition them, telling them how to sit, how to behave. And, of course, you've got four dames being told how to behave by a cameraman. It raises an eyebrow. So, again, if you're into theatre, if you're into movies, if you have a memory of some really great acting, this is a very lively conversation. The movie is called Tea with the Dames, and the dames are Joan Plowright, Maggie Smith, Judi Dench, and Eileen Atkins. Highly recommended, a fun film to see over the holiday period.
Well, thank you for that, Peter. We look forward to that.
Now, I've been really going down memory lane this week by the sound of things, because my other recommendation is The Old Man with the Gun. And here we go. It's Robert Redford in what may well be his last acting movie.
I think he said that was going to be his last one, yeah.
Yeah, he may not be his last directing movie. But here we have shades of Sundance. We've got that happy smile, the glinting eyes. And it is the story of a bank robber, mostly a true story, who never, ever uses a gun. So although the title is called Man with a Gun, all he does when he walks into a bank to do the robbing is to show underneath his jacket that there is a gun. So it's a totally non-violent bank robbing movie, a most unusual thing nowadays. And as the story develops, you begin to realize that he's not in it for the money. It must be really strange to be a bank robber and not doing the job for the cash you can get. It's a story about lifestyles. It's a story about running against the convention. It's a story, to some extent, about a chase and hunter movie, because the detective is out to get him. And along the way is a very gentle romance with Sissy Spake, and that is a truly endearing get-together. They have all the chemistry that you would think for a great romance. And some of the scenes, particularly in small-town diners, in fact, in the opening scene, when he actually tells the truth and tells her that he is a bank robber, something she doesn't believe, you suddenly see this connection. So if you've seen many of the great Robert Redford movies, you again will find yourself flashing to performances he's given with Paul Newman, both in Sundance and later. And at the same time, you'll have a sense of the totality of Robert Redford. He's in his mid-80s now.
82, and I think his Wikipedia entry needs a bit of revision because it lists him as a retired American actor, director, producer, and businessman.
Well, in fact, he's highly active, and a good example of where his action took him in a previous film where he was playing on a shipwrecked rock. The water was wave high. It hit his one ear, and he actually has to wear a hearing aid. And since I, too, am in the magic hearing aid business, he wears his hanging out of his ear. And it's a kind of example of a little bit of eccentricity that reminds you, even though he's got the smile and the eyes and the good looks, he is 82.
Indeed. And it's based on the true story of Forrest Tucker and his rather audacious escape from San Quentin at the age of 70 to then go to an unprecedented string of heists that confounded authorities and enchanted the public. So
yeah, it is a mostly true story. One line which sticks with me comes early on. He says, I don't ride a horse. And of course, all we ever do is remember Robert Redford riding horses. And in fact, in this film, he does ride a horse. So those are two wonderful trips. They will brush away your memories. They'll bring them back to life. And I think it's interesting to see how you can take some simple themes, conversation, or in this case, bank robbing. You can tell a story without really high-end chases. There's one chase in the Robert Redford film, but this is about words, about how actors use words, how they connect through dialogue, and how they bring characters to life just as they speak. Two great fun films.
Speaking of the written word, that Old Man and the Gun was written and directed by David Lowery and stars Robert Redford along with supporting actors Casey Affleck, Danny Glover, Tom Waits, Sissy Spacek, and Spacek and others.
So those are good choices if you're going to the theatre. Now, for something totally different, and it's coming up on the weekend of November the 2nd and November the 3rd, I will be back at Humanities West. And this is 2 days of art, history, music, theatre, all brought together, and it covers the period known as the late Tsarist Russian artistic brilliance. And this is a really interesting combination of some outstanding speakers introducing us to that period of Russian from the late 19th century to the early 20th century. The Tsarist period, of course, ends in 1917 with the assassination of the Romanovs. But in between, if we move away from the politics, and I want to say the revolution of that time, we move into some great composers, some great writers, and above all, some great artists. So on the Friday evening, Robert Greenberg will be opening with a lecture that really takes us through the history of 19th century music in Russia. We move from Tchaikovsky to Rachmaninoff to Prokofiev and Stravinsky. So you're getting a good range of how Russian music began to really set the scene. Then on the next 2 days, we're going to be looking at the theatre from Pushkin. We were just talking on the program earlier about Chekhov, but there will be other writers, Dostoevsky and the Golden Age of Russian Literature. So in these two instances, we're now bringing together how both music and theatre and literature really began to thrive in the second half of the 19th century in Russia. And then we finish with the art of the time, and it was indeed the golden age of Russian art. And interestingly enough, one of the lectures is how the art relates to the word. So they bring together painting under the title of the Russian word. And Molly Brunson, who is from Yale University, will be giving that particular talk. So if you're looking, I know Russia's very much in our world today, in fact, very much in this country's world today. But now we're going to move back in time. We're moving back to the 19th century. We're looking back to the period when, in fact, the entire Russian family of the Romanovs were assassinated. But we're looking at it through a cultural perspective. What did the playwrights say or anticipate about how things might happen? And I often think of Chekhov's Cherry Orchard, which, of course, is the story of a family getting out in time and going to Paris, leaving behind the cherry orchard. Or I think about the music transition, which at the beginning of the entire program, Robert Greenberg will be talking about, where we move through some of the great composers of the 19th century, and then we're going to see how did the painters bring this together. So this is all happening at Humanities West. It's at the Marines Memorial Theatre. It begins on November the 2nd, which is a Friday evening, and runs through Saturday.
Lectures, discussions, musical performances about Russian art, music, and literature from the twilight years of Tsarist Russia. And no mention of Robert Greenberg would we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that Robert Greenberg is the featured historian and our guide for music of Shostakovich for explorations in music these next several weeks here on KLW, Monday evenings at 9, the Alexander String Quartet. Yours truly, David LaTulipa, is host for that. Thank you, Peter. Have a wonderful weekend doing that.
Looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. And it's at the Marines Memorial Theater, Humanities West.
Thanks, Peter. Links to that will be at our website, klw.org, on the Open Air page. That's Open Air for this week. My thanks to Niels Swinkels for producing the show and herding the cats and keeping the calendar straight. If you got a feature that you'd like to have on Open Air in the near future, send me an email, david@klw.org. Our shows are archived at our website as well, klw.org. Next week, I'll be talking to a good friend and an up-and-coming conductor, Chad Goodman, about the opening concert of the fifth season of Elevate Ensemble in a program entitled Iconoclasts and Freethinkers. You'll hear from the New Century Chamber Orchestra's long-standing cellists, Michelle Jokic, and also on the show, Lauren Jones, co-founder and artistic director of the Diablo Ballet, among my guests, along with Marilyn Levinson, for more about Bay Area Cabaret. Links to all of the guests that you heard today on Open Air are at klw.org. Search for Open Air or search for a guest by name. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for being with us. A little bit of music of Georges Bizet to go out. It's his birthday. He was born on this date in 1838 from his L'Arlésienne Suite, number 1.